Dan Pink has had a couple of big best-selling books, Free Agent Nation and Drive and A Whole New Mind. He's got a new book out now called To Sell Is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. Before I talk to Dan, I want to play for you a clip, a classic movie clip of Alec Baldwin saying some of the words written by David Mamet for a movie called Glengarry Glen Ross. And I bet if you're a salesperson, you've heard this as a motivational speech since then. Here's Baldwin.
A, B, C. A, always, B, B, C, closing. Always be closing. Always be closing. A, I, D, A. Attention, interest, decision, action. Attention. Do I have your attention? Interest. Are you interested? I know you are. You close or you hit the bricks. Decision. Have you made your decision for Christ? A-I-D-A. Get out there. You got the prospects coming in. You think they came in to get out of the rain? A guy don't walk on the lot lest he wants to buy. They're sitting out there waiting to give you their money. Are you going to take it? Are you man enough to take it? Go and do likewise, gents. The money's out there. You pick it up, it's yours. You don't, I got no...
That's Alec Baldwin from Glengarry Glen Ross. Dan Pink's book is about salesmen, and in his book, he says, we're all salespeople. Dan, welcome to the Big 550 KTRS.
Paul, thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
Does that still work, A, B, C, always be closing?
You know what? I think it's kind of a relic. It's a wonderful scene. It's some great writing by David Mamet in that movie. It's actually, that scene is not in the play,
right?
Glengarry Glen Ross. It's added to the movie. It's a classic cameo, but it's a little bit outdated. You know, it's really from a different world of sales. It's from the world of sales where buyers were at a disadvantage, where sellers had a huge information advantage over buyers. And so sellers could be predatory, sellers could always be closing, sellers could push and push and push. That's not our world anymore. We've gone from a world of information asymmetry, where the seller always had more information than the buyer, to a world of information parity, where buyers and sellers are more evenly matched.
So when I walk into a car dealership, for instance, I pretty much know everything about that car, and I know how much it costs that dealership to buy that car, and I'm going to be a better negotiator, right?
Precisely, and that's a huge, huge change. I mean, and I think that it's happened so quickly that it hasn't really registered with us. So, you know, 20 years ago, if you went to buy a car in St. Louis, you went to buy a Chevy Malibu. The Chevy dealer would know a lot more about cars, a lot more about Chevys, a lot more about Malibus than you ever could. Okay, that's a world of buyer beware. But today, you know, you go into that Chevy dealer and you can go in there and tell the dealer, hey, you know, I know what every other dealer in St. Louis is charging for this car.
Yep.
I've been to an online user group of Chevy Malibu owners, and those things exist. I mean, it's sad, but they exist. And I know all the ins and outs, and maybe I can find a way that there's a slight problem that'll get me a $200 discount. You mentioned the cost of the car. I interviewed a car dealer in Washington, D.C., a woman who started selling cars in the early 1980s, and she said back then the factory invoice price of the car, that is what the dealer paid for it, that piece of paper, was locked in the safe. Even the sellers didn't know what it was. Now, you know, you or I or our Aunt Frida in Carson City, Nevada, can go in there and say, I got the invoice price of the car.
So what's the new ABC then?
Well, if we've gone from this world where from information asymmetry to information parity, and if you look at the social science of persuasion influence, it yields this new set of ABCs, these kind of foundational qualities that are necessary in persuading, moving, selling others. Whether you're selling yourself for a job, whether you're selling your boss on a new idea, whether you're selling Winnebagos. And the new ABCs are A, attunement, B, buoyancy, C, clarity. Attunement, buoyancy, and clarity. Attunement is, can you take someone else's perspective, see things from their point of view? Buoyancy is, can you stay afloat in the ocean of rejection that is sales? And then C Clarity is, can you move from solving existing problems to identifying problems people don't realize that they have? And those foundational qualities, rooted in a lot of really rich, really interesting social science, are the foundation that we need to have in order to be effective in moving, persuading, influencing people today.
You know, it's the middle part of that that amazes me about people who do sales for a living, that word rejection.
Ah.
Because, I'm just your average guy. I'm not in sales, but, I can remember when I was in high school, one of the reasons I didn't ask a lot of girls out was I didn't want to have them say no.
Exactly.
The social rejection was going to be too much for me. So I could never imagine, being one of the people right down the hall from us here at the radio station who go out every day and they sell commercials for the radio station. And I know that a majority of the time they're told no, not because people don't want to buy radio time or don't like KTRS, but because that's the nature of the job.
Precisely, and it's really, really hard. I mean, this, I interviewed this, I found one of the last Fuller Brush men in America.
Whoa.
A guy named...
Dan, there's still a Fuller Brush... Are you mean somebody who goes door-to-door in neighborhoods, knocks on the door, and tries to convince people to buy brushes on the doorstep?
Yes, which is something that that most Americans under 40 have no recollection of.
Yeah.
I actually, being over 40, I actually remember the Fuller Brush guy coming to our house at one point. And Fuller Brush is a really interesting American business story. At one point, these guys were ubiquitous. I have a problem with startling factoids and that I'm both a junkie and a pusher, but I'll give you one startling factoid here.
Okay.
1 year in the 1950s, Fuller Brush men, they were almost always men too. 1 year in the 1950s, Fuller Brush men made 50 million sales calls in a year in the United States. At a time when the United States had only 43 million households.
Oh, wow.
So they were ubiquitous, knocking on your door. They would have this thing called a handy brush, which is a small vegetable scrubber. They would give it to you for free to try to get a foot in the door. The whole phrase, foot in the door, comes from Fuller Brush men. In fact, the founder of the company, his autobiography, which came out about 50 years ago, is called A Foot in the Door. Anyway, so there aren't many of them doing that. In fact, I live in Washington, D.C. If my kids saw some dude they'd never seen before with these bulging bag sample cases full of brushes ringing the doorbell asking to talk to their mom, they would be calling 911.
Yep.
There's this really wonderful man named Norman Hall in San Francisco who's been doing this for 40 years, and he still goes door-to-door in the business district of San Francisco selling Fuller Brushes. And what he said, Paul, which is so, and I think it's so rich and so consistent with the way that a lot of us feel, the way that you were describing, is that, and this is his phrase, he said, the hardest part about being in sales is every day you face an ocean of rejection.
Yep.
I mean, it's just amazing. But what's interesting is that the social science gives us some ways to stay afloat on that ocean. For instance, there's research from the University of Pennsylvania showing that the best predictor of sales success, again, whether you're asking people out on dates or whether you're selling brushes, is how you explain failure. There's a certain style, what they call an explanatory style, where you explain failure, you look for ways to legitimately, honestly explain failure as more external than personal. Okay, it's not entirely my fault. You look for ways to explain failure so that it isn't pervasive, but it is occasional. It doesn't always happen. And then you look for ways to explain it as temporary rather than permanent. And failure rejection is so toxic to us. We hate it so much, even experienced salespeople, that it feels like a catastrophe. And what the social scientists talk about, and it's a really interesting word, are some ways that human beings can decatastrophize failure, decatastrophize rejection.
The book is called To Sell as Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. Dan Pink, I'm Paul Harris here on the Big 550 KTRS. In reading through the book, I kept saying the same thing to myself over and over again, and it goes back to that rejection thing from high school, I'm sure, which is that I don't think of myself as a salesperson.
Yeah.
But you make the case in here that 1 in 9 people are professional salespeople, but the other 8 of us should consider ourselves salespeople, right?
Absolutely. Like it or not, that's the truth. We're spending a huge portion, there's a lot of data on this, we're spending huge portions of our time on the job convincing, persuading people to basically give up something that they have for what we have. And, on this radio show. You're trying to, you know, you're trying to sell people on the idea of continuing listening. On, hey, listen to me. I'm going to entertain you. I'm going to enlighten you. I'm going to inform you that you're, you know, give me your attention and give me your time. And in exchange, I will give you entertainment, insight, something to talk about around the water cooler. Mm-hmm. And that is sales, like it or not. And it's a big portion of what we do every day, especially on the job.
How much does social media now play a part in that? Because you and I are both on Twitter. You're using it to promote your book. I used it to promote the fact that you're going to come on here and talk about your book. And I also tweet jokes and all sorts of other things. How much is social media impacting the whole idea of sales in this country?
Well, it's given us another way to sell ourselves. I mean, I see your tweet here, Paul. About this hour on KTRS, I'm talking to Daniel Pink.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's that? So that tweet right there is saying, hey, pay attention. Take a little bit of your time and give it to me, and in exchange, I'll give you this enlightening, fascinating interview with this guy you've never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it does is that it gives us more channels to get our ideas out, and it gives us more channels to sell our ideas, but it also gives us many more opportunities for rejection. So you put up a post, and people don't like it on Facebook. You put up a tweet, and people don't retweet it. But social media is another reason why more and more of us are spending our time, again, like it or not, in sales.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you to tell a couple of stories here that I really enjoyed, if you don't mind. One of them is the hospital hygiene story.
Oh, yeah.
Would you mind sharing that with
the audience? This is a really interesting piece of research. So it's some research out of University of North Carolina. And here's what happened. So there's a big problem in hospitals. In that called hospital-acquired infections. You go to a hospital, and then you come out of the hospital, you get into the hospital, and you get an infection in the hospital, okay?
Yeah.
You get a new problem from being in there. The most effective way to reduce hospital-acquired infections is for doctors, nurses, orderlies to wash their hands. Unfortunately, the hand-washing compliance inside of hospitals is a shocking 60%, meaning 40% of the times that doctors and nurses, et cetera, should wash their hands, they don't. That's freaking frightening to me.
Yeah.
And
particularly if they're going to be touching me,
yes.
or even worse, touching the inside of me.
Yes. Or touching someone we love and care about.
Yes.
So how do we get doctors and nurses to wash their hands? There have been all kinds of mechanisms for that. But these two scholars, David Hoffman and Adam Grant, one is at University of North Carolina, one wasn't at North Carolina, he's now at Wharton. They tested out different kinds of messages. So what they did is they put signs next to the soap and hand sanitizer dispensers to try to persuade, move, sell doctors, nurses, et cetera, on the idea of washing their hands. So they tried three different kinds of signs in this big hospital. One sign said, hand washing prevents you from catching diseases. Okay, message to the doctors and nurses. Hand hygiene prevents you from catching disease.
Yep.
Number two, hand hygiene prevents patients from getting disease. And then number three was a kind of groovy marketing slogan, gel in, wash out. Okay? And so,
please tell me that gel in, wash out was the least effective.
Well, fortunately, you know what's interesting is that a lot of people thought that the gel in, wash out would be the most effective. And it turned out that two of them had absolutely no effect. And one of them had as big an effect as anything tried before. And fortunately, Paul, you're right, gel in, wash out had no effect. What's curious is that the appeal to the doctors, nurses, orderlies' self-interest, hand hygiene prevents you from catching diseases, also had no effect. What had an effect is the sign that said hand hygiene prevents patients from catching diseases. And there's an interesting body of research showing that appealing to a sense of purpose is surprisingly effective. Not all the time for all people, but there's a lot of persuasive capacity being left on the table by not making that appeal to purpose. And what they did is that they said, remember why you're here. You know, you became a doctor, you became a nurse because you actually wanted to make people better, not more sick.
Yep.
And there's a lot of really interesting evidence showing that appeal to purpose can be effective in many cases. The other thing that's valuable about that, you know, for those of your listeners who are in organizations, is that it's basically free. I mean, it doesn't cost you much money to appeal to a sense of purpose. Some of these other kinds of techniques we use to get people to do things end up being very costly, end up being very complicated to administer. But this appeal to purpose ends up being surprisingly effective.
All right, one other thing, and then I'm going to let you go here. One other story I'm going to ask you to tell, Dan, and that is four words for a blind man.
Oh, yeah, okay. So this is interesting. This is a famous story from an ad man named Rosser Reeves. He was one of the guys who came up with the slogan, "I like Ike." Famous ad man from the 1950s. It's a very well-known story in the annals of advertising. It might even be true. And so but we're not going to let the fact-checking get in the way of, I think, a very powerful tale and a very good lesson for all of us. So Here's the story. It's springtime in New York City. Rosser Reeves and one of his colleagues are walking through Central Park after lunch. They see a guy sitting in Central Park, a guy who is blind, and he has a sign that says, "I am blind," and he has a little cup that says in which to collect money from people passing by. Okay, so it's a beautiful spring day. People are walking by, but no one is putting money into his cup. Very few people are putting money into his cup, even though the guy has a sign that says, "I am blind." Rosser Reeves says to his colleague, "You know, I could add four words to that sign and dramatically increase the amount of money he's raising." And so the story goes, his colleague says, "All right, good, I'll make you a bet. I'll bet you $5 that, you know, you can do it." So Rosser Reeves goes over to the blind man. He writes something on his sign, and he adds four words to the sign. And suddenly, people start walking by. Plink, money goes in. Plink, money goes in. A few dollars go in. The cup is now overflowing with money. And when his friend looked to see what Rosser Reeves had written, the four words he had written, it was, "It is springtime and I am blind." And the idea here is that we're always asking ourselves the question, if you want to persuade people, the question isn't always what's in it for me, but the question is, compared to what? And by offering that kind of contrast, by offering that context, we can become more persuasive. So maybe back in the days when you were in high school, you should have said, "It is springtime, and would you go out with me?"
Yeah, but then they would have looked at me, and then that would have been the end of it to begin. Anyway, it is a wonderful book, yet another in a terrific series of books from Daniel Pink. It's called To Sell is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. It's always a pleasure talking to you, Dan. Thanks for your time today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.